Hey, everybody. It is noon here in Bellows Falls, Vermont. I am KMO, and you are listening to Sea Realm Radio. And today is the day. 15 years ago today, we all woke up to a rude surprise. At least, I was on the west coast of the United States. I was living in Washington State. So for me, it was earlier in the day than it was here on the east coast when I learned that the United States had been attacked. We didn't know who the attackers were. We just knew that they were flying planes into buildings in Washington, D.C. and New York City. So that's going to be the topic of conversation for the next 2 hours here on Sea Realm Radio. In the first hour, I'm going to share a conversation. Well, I'd say that I've recorded recently. It's not recorded. It will be a live phone call. The guest, his name is Mark Rabinowitz. He runs a website called oilempire.us. It is a very visually friendly site with lots of information that is just readily available. So I would suggest that if this is a topic of interest to you, you might open up that site right now. Again, it's oilempire.us. But of course, this being a community radio station, the first thing I want to do is share with you some information about things happening in your local community. So first up, a look under the covers of the magazine publishing business will be the topic of a talk at Main Street Arts Tuesday, September 15th at 6 p.m. The first in this year's Taste of the Arts series features Saxons River residents Meg Lucas and Barbie Schreiber, who founded and published the quarterly magazine Vermont's Local Banquet, which covers local food, sustainable farming, and the people building the Vermont food system. Through its stories, the magazine shows the connections between local food and Vermont communities and how Vermonters are building their local food systems, how farmers are faring in a time of great opportunity and challenge, and how the state's agricultural landscape is changing as the locavore movement shapes what is grown and raised here. The talk will be preceded by a locally prepared dinner. Sounds pretty good, huh? Reservations are required by Tuesday, September 13th, and can be made by contacting Main Street Arts at area code 802-869-2960 or via email info@mainstreetarts.org or go online. It's www.mainstreetarts.org. Tickets for the talk and dinner are $24 for adults and $12 for children under 12 who are accompanied by an adult. The series has a food-related theme this year, with the October 13th event, a dinner and talk with Michael Klug, chocolatier of L.A. Burdock Chocolates. So again, that's put on by Main Street Arts, and you can find more information at their website, www.mainstreetarts.org. And next up, I saw this yesterday. This is an amazing movie. It is Kubo and the Two Strings. It is a stop-motion animated feature by the same artisanal movie production company that brought us the movie Caroline, which I haven't seen, but which I'm going to go seek out now because I was so impressed by Kubo and the Two Strings. It is, as I say, animated. It's a story of a young boy named Kubo who must locate a magical suit of armor worn by his late father in order to defeat a vengeful spirit from the past. It stars the voices of Charlize Theron, Art Parkinson, and Matthew McConaughey. And I cannot stress enough how good this movie is. So it is playing at the Bellows Falls Opera House Theater through Tuesday, September 13th. Last show is at 7:15 p.m. Do yourself a favor and go see this film on the big screen here in Bellows Falls. It is an amazing film. Alrighty, so I'm expecting the phone to ring at any moment now, but while I'm waiting for that to happen, let me just pop on over to the guest of this hour's website. Again, his name is Mark Rabinowitz. The website that I'm looking at now is oilempire.us, and now I'm looking at a section that's /gatekeepers. So here on the website, Mark is talking about what he calls the left gatekeepers. These are the people who are supposedly opposed to empire, supposedly opposed to the perpetual war that we seem to be caught up in now. But, well, the title of the article is Left Gatekeepers, the Stand Down of the Foundation-Funded Alternative Media, the Politics, the Psychology, the Practice, the Personnel. progressive censorship about the reasons for the so-called war on terror. Nonprofits usually depend on someone else's profits. So first up is a quote from Julian Assange, who says, When an organization accepts funding from governments or from establishment organizations like the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation, who are its real interlocutors? And Eric Hoffer, long dead, writes, woe to him inside a nonconformist clique who does not conform with nonconformity, which is to say that even if you are in an alternative, a community organized around an alternative viewpoint, there are still rules imposed in terms of maintaining ideological purity. You know, if you're going to be a rebel, you have to be a rebel in the exact same way as the other people in your rebel group. There is a man, I'm pretty sure I have shared with you a conversation that I recorded with him before he died. His name is Joe Bagent. And Joe Bagent, well, as I say, he has passed. But he wrote a book called Deer Hunting with Jesus, which is basically, Joe Bagent is from the South. He considers himself a redneck, but he also got out and got educated, took a lot of LSD, drank some ayahuasca, and had a viewpoint that incorporated the best of what the intellectual elite of the coasts had to offer, but he maintained a thoroughgoing defense of so-called rednecks and white trash. And he's somebody who I dearly miss, Joe Bidge, and I wish he was still with us. But there is a short essay on the oilempire.us website by Joe Bagent. And just while I'm waiting for this week's guest to call in, I'm going to share as much of this essay with you as I can. It's only about five paragraphs. Joe Bagent writes, goodbye, Terry Gross. Oh, never mind. Here is the phone ringing. So while I answer it, let me play a song by the Beastie Boys. This is their love letter to New York City, the city I think we can all agree was most affected by the events of September 11th, 2001. All right, that was the Beastie Boys with a love letter to New York City. And now I think I have got Mark Rabinowitz on the line. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, KMF.
Hey, Mark. Good to talk to you. Keep talking so I can get your volume levels right.
Good morning, good afternoon, whichever time zone you're in.
It is just afternoon here in Bellows Falls, Vermont, and you are calling from Oregon. What part of Oregon are you in?
I am in Eugene, Oregon, in the south part of the Willamette Valley.
And you're on your homestead farm.
Talking with solar electricity. Sunny day.
We had a crazy rainstorm this morning. It just dumped a whole bunch of water down on the ground in a very short period, and now the sun's come out, and I see blue sky, but also glowering dark clouds. So maybe that's a metaphor for the times we live in. Right now, we're in a sunny patch.
So 15 years. Has it really been that long?
Yeah, I think it has. I'm convinced that the time has actually passed and that 15 trips around the sun have taken place since that day, because my life has changed so much since then. And it's impossible. I never even really try, but it's impossible to explain to my kids the difference in the world that I grew up in compared to the world that they grow up in, and particularly the difference between, I'd say the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century, because while it happened a year after, the big odometer moment of the year 2000, really that event, September 11th, 2001, to me marks the dividing line between the 20th century and the world that we live in now.
Thank you for saying that.
Well, Mark, you have a line on, I suppose before we really get into the conversation, there will be people listening to this who are not familiar with you at all. Would you just give a brief introduction to yourself, your interests, and your connection to this topic?
Well, I'm almost 53 years old. I've been a political writer and activist and permaculture practitioner for most of my adult life. been interested in what some call the deep state and its influence on world events and domestic events, and peeling away the veil that keeps the shadow government hiding in the shadows, directing our responses to the state of the world, ecological overshoot, keeping us in a state of fear instead of using our collective resources for peaceful transition. In a way, it was very personally, I'm not quite sure what the right word is, but I'm glad that when the horrors of 9/11 happened, to have been an adult and to be aware of the history of other deep state events, such as the coup d'etat of November 1963 and Iran-Contra and many other scandals. I have friends who are younger who were in grade school when it happened, and to try to make sense of the world and that shocking of an event as a kid must be even more difficult than to make sense of it as an adult, let alone an adult who's been interested in deconstructing and pulling apart the puzzles of how these sorts of violent events take place, why they're allowed to happen, the societal response to them, and why we have endless war on a finite planet.
So you have been investigating and collecting information on the events of 9/11. You have a section of your website, oilempire.us, devoted to it. And on that website, you have a very handy chart which divides conspiracy theories, you know, for lack of a better term, about 9/11 into those which are clearly false, those which are dodgy, and those which deserve more attention. What are some of the ones that are clearly not worth thinking about?
Well, perhaps we could start with what is the best evidence and work backwards from that.
Okay.
My initial response was reading in the days after the attacks, there were a huge number of fairly mainstream media reports about different countries that had warned the Bush-Cheney White House that the attacks were about to happen. Some of the warnings were very specific: who, what, where, when. There was a story, I think it was in Newsweek, where it said that John Ashcroft, who was head of the Justice Department, had been warned not to fly. There were other articles about military people being given similar warnings. The mayor of San Francisco at the time said that he had been warned not to fly that day. You had Britain, France, Germany, Russia, Israel, Egypt, a number of other countries sent very specific warnings about some of the hijackers. It later transpired that some of the rank-and-file agents in the FBI and the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency had been trying to do their jobs to prevent the attacks, and in each case were overruled by their superiors in the agencies. That's obstruction of justice. That's a felony. It then leaked out through the media that some of these agencies had been practicing military exercises simulating the actual events of 9/11 as 9/11 unfolded. So one of the most outrageous of these was the CIA was conducting a plane into building exercise at the National Reconnaissance Office headquarters near Dulles Airport in Virginia, close to where the plane that hit the Pentagon took off from. So they were doing this exercise simulating not precisely the events that unfolded, but that made my coincidence meter overload to read that the CIA was doing a plane into building exercise at one of the most sensitive sites in the country at the same time that the actual plane turned around. That was in Associated Press on the wire service, but it wasn't in the 9/11 Commission report.
Well, the 9/11 Commission report is has some very conspicuous holes in it, like the fact that Building 7, which was the third skyscraper to collapse in Manhattan that day, isn't even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report?
Well, Building 7 is a very complicated topic. It's become seized on by most of the so-called 9/11 truth movement as the smoking gun, so to speak, of complicity. Yet, when you read what the firefighters who were there were saying, they watched the towers buckle and lean before they came down, and they knew by mid-afternoon that Building 7, which was across the street, was going to collapse because it had a huge hole on the south side that was caused by part of the towers collapsing onto it. The first time a skyscraper has ever fallen onto another skyscraper. So buildings that lean and fall over that way, it looks like controlled demolition, but it is not. And unfortunately, the media has been very shrewd at hyping up the controlled demolition theory and ignoring the best evidence of suppressed warnings and overlapping war games that confuse the response. But this is a pattern of manipulation by the media, and not just the mainstream media, the quote alternative media has done it too, to misdirect and focus on minutiae or false evidence that appears real.
Just before you called, I was sharing some information from your website with the listeners, and I had mentioned the what you describe as the foundation-supported alternative media and their particular blind spots. Would you talk about that for a bit?
Well, you have a number of culprits, if I can use that word. Perhaps the biggest one would be Democracy Now!,
which airs on this station.
And most of what Democracy Now! Covers is very good. I'd certainly rather listen to Democracy Now! Than National Public Radio, which in some ways is just as bad as Fox TV, although for a different audience. How many people know that the head of National Public Radio a few years ago came from Voice of America, which is a U.S. government propaganda arm that was originally set up by the Central Intelligence Agency. So Democracy Now! Covers a lot of topics that NPR or CBS, that's a great name for a network, will not ever touch. But they won't touch a couple of things that are verboten. They won't touch deep state events like 9/11 or the Kennedy assassination. They will not touch the limits to growth. They will not touch peak energy. And they don't have on people who suggest, most importantly, that if you're concerned about any or all of these kind of things, that we need to work together in our communities to relocalize production, especially of food, and do practical logistical things to prepare for energy downslope, ecological collapse, in a word, and work in the transition town type approach. I don't know if you've covered that movement or not.
Not on the radio program.
Well, relocalization is going to be more important, in my view, than waving protest signs. Because after you finish waving the protest signs, we still have to ensure that our communities are taken care of logistically in terms of food and shelter and all the rest. And these are not isolated causes that leftists can champion. These are fundamental shifts that affect everybody, regardless of which 19th century philosopher you prefer.
I imagine you're familiar with Derek Jensen's pretty famous essay saying that, composting and community gardens didn't stop the Nazis, and that's not the solution to our current dilemma. You know, we have to fight power.
Well, there's some truth in that. But if we don't take care of the logistics of being fed, people are not going to be able to do much political organizing either. And part of the fighting of power is a paradigm that increases centralized power. I'm skeptical that leftists overthrowing the powers that be are going to be all that much better. I prefer evolution to revolution, personally. We've tried revolution as a species, and most of the time it doesn't work out the way we like.
Well, we started off talking about some of the best evidence for something fishy going on 9/11. But then there's a whole other category of evidence so terrible, so loony, that it smacks of disinformation. Would you talk about that?
Well, one of the ways that the control system keeps people from looking closer at these events is to smear controversial topics with a thick layer of ridicule. This was pioneered in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, where there's an endless variety of ludicrous and, frankly, insulting claims, but you can now read them to your heart's content thanks to the Internet. But before the Internet, there's books and movies and all the rest. The Internet has sped it up. My favorite example of disinformation as applied to complicity in 9/11 is the hoax that a missile was fired at the Pentagon instead of Flight 77. Now, this was first unveiled by U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld about a month after the attacks. We don't need to question what Donald Rumsfeld's motivations were. They should be pretty transparent to everybody. Now, I'm not saying that everybody who echoes this is doing so with malicious intent. I almost got caught up in it myself when I was first investigating what was going on. It's a very clever hoax. It was compelling until I looked closer and then realized, oh, that's not actually correct. But it did wonders to discredit allegations of complicity, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, where hundreds of people saw what happened from nearby roads and other vantage points, and hundreds more were involved in the grisly task of sifting through the wreckage and pulling airplane parts and luggage and bodies out of the rubble. So this sort of misdirection, it's done beautifully right now with the election campaign that's underway, where if you don't like one candidate, you're free to hate the other candidate even more. So we have this contest of, do you hate Hillary more or do you hate Donald more, when neither are even remotely what we need to deal with the crises that we face as a society.
So with disinformation, I mean, you talked earlier about the idea that the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition and how that is misinformation. And yet so many people grab onto that. I know that it's certainly true of me when I saw the video of Building 7 coming down. It's not crazy to say that looks like a controlled demolition. And so if you can identify the whole of 9/11 skepticism with the controlled demolition theory and then disprove the controlled demolition theory, then psychologically you have disproved, you know, any, you have taken legitimacy away from any criticism of the official story, when nothing, that's not true at all. I mean, that's one piece. And the fact that, you know, the buildings came down in the way that the official narrative says doesn't discredit the entirety of, you know, the notion that something was not above board, something fishy happened that day.
The video clip that I think is a lot more important than, the video clip I think that is a lot more important than the buildings collapsing is the footage showing alleged President George Bush sitting in the classroom in Florida being told that the second tower had been hit and sitting there like a lump on a log doing nothing. Now, a lot of people, I assume your listeners and people in Vermont and people in New York City for that matter, realize that George Bush was not the smartest and shrewdest person to ever inhabit the Oval Office. But it is not about him as an interloper. The military has a system run by the National Security Agency that is designed to get a warning of an attack to the President and the White House military office within a couple of minutes. It's designed for responding to a nuclear attack on the country. They did not use the warning systems to get the president to respond appropriately that morning. watching the footage of Bush being told that the attack is underway and the second tower had just been hit, and do nothing, and worse, the Secret Service and the rest of his entourage do nothing, the only possible rational explanation is that they knew the scale of the attacks, or somebody in the system knew the scale of the attacks, and therefore didn't respond. If it was truly a surprise, Bush's location was public information, it was known. They would have scrambled to get him out of there much faster than they did, just like they would have scrambled faster to get fighter jets to intercept the off-course planes.
So you're saying that the media's focus on George Bush just sitting there and continuing to read My Pet Goat to elementary school children, what does that say about the intent of the media?
Well, the media is not in cahoots with big business and the government. They are big business and the government. On my website, oilempire.us, I have a link in the media section to an article that was written back in the 1970s by Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame called The CIA and the Media. And what he uncovered is that just about every major media institution has an editor or a director or someone in a senior level of management with ties to the so-called intelligence agencies. So the media knows what they can and cannot do. That's why we don't need censors, because they know what they're supposed to do and what are the range of acceptable discourse. And to talk about the non-response before or during the attacks of our trillion-dollar warning system, that would raise too many questions. But a deeper level is those who enabled the attacks, those who suppressed the warnings that they were coming, those who facilitated the war games to paralyze the air defense and confuse it, they would not have dared to do it unless they knew they'd get away with it. Just like those who were behind the Kennedy assassination would not have dared to do such a subversive crime if they didn't know they wouldn't get away with it. It's a double or nothing, and they were rigged in favor of it, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. There are some prevailing narratives, I think, largely on the left about what happened on 9/11. These are not conspiracy theories. They are opinions, you might say, or attitudes. One is that the hijackers and the attacks they happened because of incompetence on the part of the people and the systems which are in place to defend the United States from attack from the outside, particularly, you know, this most critical area of the United States in terms of its its government and its economic big power players. You know, New York City and Washington, D.C. should be the most heavily guarded spaces within our borders, and yet that's exactly where the attack succeeded. So the criticism that arises is that, well, you know, all of these billions and billions of dollars that we're spending on national defense are being squandered or misspent or somehow not producing the effect that they're supposed to.
Well, it's a tempting argument, and there's some pieces of truth in it. However, consider the Federal Aviation Administration, which had the unprecedented task of landing over 4,000 commercial airplanes in an unplanned way. No collisions happened. They got everybody out of the air pretty quickly, something they'd never done before. That's not incompetence. That was extremely competent. They did an amazing job ensuring the safety of the people on the planes that were not hijacked. I think the incompetence theory applies more to the media, where they were too incompetent to start connecting the dots between all the disparate stories in the mainstream corporate media, that there was more than ample foreknowledge that the attacks were coming. And most of these foreknowledge documentations, they were not in the 9/11 Commission report. They have not been compiled to connect the dots in the media. And even the so-called alternative media has shied away from doing that, because once you start to show that there's absolutely no excuse that they didn't know it was coming, then you end up with a much bigger problem, which is, why do we have these power structures that are callous enough to allow an attack like 9/11 to happen to our country? And the answer, of course, is without that sort of attack, there is no way we would have been able to politically have the ability to attack Iraq to grab the oil.
An argument that I've heard, and makes sense enough to me that I've probably passed it on a time or two, is that whoever controls the oil in the Middle East is in the oil business. They'll need to sell it. If they can't sell it, then it's really not a whole lot of use to them. And so if you want the oil in the Middle East, you don't really have to create the conditions to justify a war and go and invade. You can just buy the oil from the people who control it right now. I mean, that's what they want it for, is to sell it.
Well, that's true. But it's also true that Cheney and his friends in the oil business have tracked the topic of peak oil for a long time. And Cheney's on record saying that they understood that the peak was approaching. And the peak of conventional oil globally was around 2005, 2006. Having military forces in the Persian Gulf enables the United States to have leverage power over the direction that that oil flows. Because in the coming years, there's going to be more and more scramble for who controls the oil. And the oil, the direction that the oil flows is similar to the direction that water flows in the desert. Oil is the fuel that powers our global economy more than anything else. And when you have conflicts over water in a desert, that determines where food can be grown, which is, of course, the basis of civilization. So it's true that merely selling the oil is a lot easier than dispatching troops, but as the oil declines, there's going to be more of that competition for who gets what's left. This also allows the United States to leverage political and economic power over Europe, over China, over other countries that are dependent on the oil from the Middle East. Most of the Middle East oil doesn't go to the United States. It goes to Europe and East Asia.
You have mentioned the Kennedy assassination, and in an email you wrote to me, there are many parallels between 9/11 and the removal of JFK from the presidency. Perhaps the most important is that the perpetrators and enablers would not have dared if they hadn't known in advance that they could get away with it. You've already mentioned that. But then you write, preventing future events like this would require many aspects of consciousness evolution. One component I would like to discuss is the paradigm of a South Africa-style truth and reconciliation commission.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a process that was established in South Africa shortly after the transition from apartheid to democracy. It was chaired by Desmond Tutu, and he and Mandela and others realized they had a very explosive situation at the end of apartheid. The country had been through civil war. Horrible atrocities had been perpetrated on both sides, more on the government side, but plenty on the revolutionary side too. And they needed to defuse the situation. So the Truth and Reconciliation Commission gave a platform for victims to testify about what they'd suffered, and also for perpetrators to make a deal with the government. They would get amnesty for prosecution if they were willing to discuss what they had done for political crimes. It was not a perfect thing. The family of Steve Biko, for example, was fairly opposed to this. They wanted their husbands and fathers' murderers to be put in jail, and that did not happen. They spoke in public. But it was probably about the best approach that could have been taken to keep the country sort of governable. And we need a similar process here with the national security state, with all the war crimes that we have committed around the world. Excuse me, with the Kennedy assassination, with allowing 9/11, the war in Vietnam, the history of what the U.S. did to indigenous people, slavery and reparations, it's a long list. Violence committed by cops,
Mark, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, great. Sounded like you ended mid-sentence there. South Africa had just had a revolution, basically. The people who had committed the atrocities were no longer in power, and there was the potential for just a wave of revenge, basically. And so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the protocols were sort of an escape valve, to let off steam, to ease back from a cultural explosion of violence. But that doesn't seem to be the situation that we're facing here in the United States right now. I mean, 9/11 is in the news today because it's. But aside from that, it's basically just it's a historical event now. It's a point on the map, but it's not really a source of ongoing cultural tension, as far as I can tell.
Well, there was more potential for understanding the reality of 9/11 and the facilitation of it to help with political shifts in the early days after that, when George Bush was still in the White House. Now that he is gone, now that his understudy Barack Obama is on his way out, most likely with Hillary to replace him, it's ancient history, especially if you were in grade school at the time. The pre-9/11 world wasn't part of your experience. Just like, for people a little older, the JFK assassination had a similar impact.
Right. That happened 5 years before I was born, so I have no memory of, a world before that event. My world just assumes that. And I think the world of, say, the millennials assumes 9/11. It's not anything to get worked up about for them. It's just something that happened in the past.
So we are not in any way even close to having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the United States. But it's worked in a number of other countries besides South Africa. And if we do have that sort of shift in our culture, in our collective consciousness, that's a model that might have more usefulness than pecking at a touchscreen voting machine for Hillary or Donald or anybody else. Part of the problem also is that we are taught that there are three branches of the government and we're a democracy in the best of all possible worlds. And what we actually have is two governments. We have the overt government we're taught about in civics class, and we have the national security state, the covert government, which holds all the power. And to be president, you have to have served the empire. That's one of the prerequisites. It's why Bernie Sanders never had a chance, because he was not part of that. The Clintons were part of that. Obama was part of that. The Bushes obviously are part of that. The problem of our President Kennedy is he stood up to the national security state, called for an end to the Cold War and the arms race, and took practical steps to scatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces, as he put it. And, of course, they scattered him into 1,000 pieces. Now, these are not history things to recall for even necessarily prosecuting people, because the judicial system does not really have practical authority over the national security state. I raise these more out of a sense that we need to understand what's happened, understand our collective fear and silence about it as a society, and use this understanding because we need to convert the military-industrial complex to peaceful purposes if we're going to deal with climate change, if we're going to deal with resource depletion, overpopulation, all the rest. It may be too late to do that, but we have to try. And the resources for coping with our situation past peak, and now that we're into climate change, they're locked up in the military. And preparing for endless war on a finite planet means we won't have a planet to live on.
You mentioned the fourth branch of government, the National Security State, or the Deep State. Bill Moyers, you know, and a hero of the alternative media, or the sort of alternative media over at PBS. His show now is called Moyers and Company, and he recently had a guest on. His name was Mike Lofgren, and Mike Lofgren also contributed an essay called Anatomy of the Deep State, which you can find on BillMoyers.com, in which he talks about a lot of the things that you're talking about. And I'm wondering how you would see someone like Mike Lofgren coming forward and speaking in a fairly high-profile, respectable venue, you know, like PBS, about this issue. Is this something that you think of as a sort of limited hangout, or is this the beginning of a good trend?
I think the Moyer Show is definitely a limited hangout. Limited hangout is a term where small bits of truth are unveiled and people can easily confuse it as being the full story. I read the transcript of that presentation. It was pretty good. But it failed to mention some of the specifics. The coming out party, as it were, of the National Security State was the assassination of President Kennedy in November 1963. At that time, Bill Moyers was a staff person for the White House, and he was then dispatched shortly after that to help with setting up the Warren Commission, which was the cover-up that claimed that Lee Harvey Oswald was the shooter. There were three bullets fired in Dealey Plaza, and he was just a lone nut who was inspired by communism and all the rest. Now, Bill Moyers is at the end of his career. It would be very nice for him to come clean in a truth and reconciliation style to ask why he went along with helping his associates in the White House set up the Warren Commission and then ignore it for the next half century. You know, the collective silence in the media over the assassination and why it happened, that alone tells you who did it. Because if it was a lone nut, you know, that's not even the official story anymore after the 1978 House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation in Congress. They admitted there were two shooters, which is a little closer to the truth. But if it was the mafia that was behind the assassination, would the media and the political system have been afraid to look closer and to prosecute? The mafia has some power, but not that much, and certainly not much in the media, unless Donald Trump becomes president, which I don't think will happen. And we need this sort of coming clean in order to move forward if we're going to end endless war. So I know people have tried to raise these things with the Moyer Show and have gotten nowhere, but he's an old man. He's well-respected, and if he were to talk about this honestly, it would get a lot of positive attention.
So do you think his broaching of the topic recently is, do you think it's the beginning of a new era, a new period for him and being honest about his role and about what he knows, or do you think it's just sort of the token gesture in that direction so that he can sleep at night?
My guess is more the latter, but part of it would have to be his audience asking for details, asking for more investigation, I mean, with Edward Snowden in the news and other aspects of the deep state getting a little more attention, there's been more focus on the three-letter agencies than there was, say, a decade ago. But some specifics would help a lot. And the most important specifics in our lifetime are JFK and 9/11.
I also think about the Oklahoma bombing in this, you know, in this framework when we're talking about big events that people seized on as evidence of nefarious conspiracies by very entrenched and powerful interests within the United States government. I wonder what your thoughts are on how Oklahoma City fits into the big picture.
I am not as familiar with the details on that, but there are independent investigators who have charged that there was foreknowledge that that attack was going to happen and that the ATF agents were not in the building when the attack happened. There's also claims that there was more than one bomb. I don't really know enough to comment on that. But what's more important is not the technical details, but that it was used as a trial run for the Patriot Act, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which the first President Clinton signed, and it restricts all sorts of civil liberties and processes for innocent people to challenge their convictions in court. It was the type of legislation that would be more appropriate for Richard Nixon than a so-called liberal Democrat.
Well, Richard Nixon would be a liberal Democrat by today's political standards.
And today's Republicans are more like the John Birch Society.
Which is to say, loony.
Yeah, and that's the scary part of having Trump going around whipping up all this craziness. It's not that he's likely to win unless the Hillary campaign has a meltdown, but what he is fueling is a lot of anger and backlash and misdirected focus on racist appeals and all the rest, which is going to last long after Trump loses in November 8 and starts a media company or whatever his post-election plans are. We did a show a couple years ago on Sea Realm called Peak Blame about the increasing vitriol in the society as we compete over finite resources. And Donald Trump is the epitome of increasing peak blame.
Yes, he stokes anger and attributes the causes of people's misery to... He directs their attention away from the actual cause and to the scapegoat.
And he's very good at it. I think the antidote to increasing scapegoating would be not just truth and reconciliation, but recognizing that we have an abundant planet that is finite, that endless growth could not continue forever, and we are going to have to change AWOL, the American way of life, so that we can have a planet our great-grandchildren can inherit from us. Unfortunately, even most of the left in the nonprofit world, the environmental groups, 350, etc., they are pushing the paradigm of green growth, that we can all have electric cars and offset our carbon emissions by buying credits and vote for Democrats who will save us from the horrible Republicans. The truth is a little more stark. We're going to have to get our fingers dirty in the dirt and relocalize food production and recognize that we have to cut our own overambitions on how much of the world we can exploit. And that's not as sellable of a message because it forces us to look in the mirror and not just to blame others who are somewhere else.
In the email that you wrote, which I quoted earlier, you wrote, "Preventing future events like these would require many aspects of consciousness evolution. It seems like 9/11 kicked off the war on terror, which is a war in perpetuity, and no further excuses are needed to do anything, really. We have just given ourselves carte blanche to do anything militarily anywhere in the world, regardless of the consequences and regardless of who objects. And it seems we are no longer dependent on a new Pearl Harbor event creating a moment where there is the opportunity to act.
Well, and since then, there have been so many terror events all over the world that the die is sort of cast. We'd have to go back and admit as a society that most people swallowed the official narrative of it was a surprise without question. I recommend a book called Crossing the Rubicon by the late Michael Rupert, which he estimated that maybe there were 2 or 3 dozen people in the federal government who had full foreknowledge of what was going on. We'll probably never know the exact number. But the cynicism that is required to understand that that sort of a violent event could be allowed to happen by those sworn to protect our safety is too much for most people, and they tune out. But the flip side of that consciousness is in the immediate aftermath of the attack, there was a tremendous global wave of solidarity with the United States, even in places like Iran, which people had normally been shouting death to America. And this global wave of solidarity was squandered by the Bush administration, probably deliberately, and now it's as much of a part of the distant past as anything else. The idea today that ordinary people all over the world have great sympathy for America is frayed, to put it politely. So we have to understand that with the ecological crash of climate change coming, we're going to need that sort of global cooperation and more if there's a possibility to get back to a stable climate, to an ecological system that is more supportive of civilization.
Mark, we're just about out of time. In the second hour of today's radio show, I'm going to play the recorded conversation that you and I made 5 years ago today. Well, maybe not 5 years ago today, but for the 10th anniversary of September 11th. How has the event changed for you, or how has the impact or the importance of it changed for you in the last 5 years?
It was more the first 5 years than the last 5 years. Not much has really changed in terms of the consciousness of what 9/11 meant. We've had the endless war started in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, and it's become an unmentionable. To raise these sorts of questions is the political third rail in our society. You touch it and you're dead. There are no institutions of any size that are raising these concerns. In the early days, I tried to pester members of Congress about these things, and a couple of them privately went, yeah, we know. But in public, they forgot. And that's true in the media. It's true in peace groups. It's true in political parties. But that's passed, and now we're looking at the downslope of the peak oil energy curve. We're looking at increasing climate change and all the disruptions that's going to increasingly have. And we need to understand that the oil wells are half full and half empty. They're half full, so we have a lot of material to work with. It takes oil to install solar panels. And they're half empty, so we can't keep growing and doing what we've been doing. And if we're really smart about it, we might be able to avoid the peak blame and the scapegoating and bypass the false duality of Democrat-Republican for seeing the human civilization as a connected whole.
Well, Mark, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thank you very much for calling in. Thanks for continuing to do the work that you do, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks again, Skyma.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, and that brings us to the end of the first hour of Sea Realm Radio for September 11th, 2016. I've been your host, KMO, and I will be again for the next hour, although much of what you will hear in the next hour will be pre-recorded. But because it is the top of the hour, let me remind you that you are listening to WOOL FM 91.5 in Bellows Falls. We are a community-supported radio station. And because we are a community-supported radio station and we are dedicated to our local community, I want to tell you about the Bellows Falls Community Bike Project. They have moved to 30 Henry Street. There will be a grand reopening and three-year celebration on Saturday, September 17th from 1 to 4 p.m. It is free. Bike-powered smoothies, popcorn, and other treats, demos, open house, and more will all be on display and available. The wonderful news.